Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic's podcast. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to Graeme Stewart about the effect that Martin Luther and the Reformation had on the German lands and whether a compromise solution existed but was missed.
Germany in the 16th century, and indeed the German-speaking lands as a whole, because the Swiss cantons in the shape of Zwingli for the Germans, and of course for the French, Switzerland, John Calvin, played a key role as well. But Germany, if we're concentrating here on the what we now call modern Germany, Germany is very much associated with Martin Luther, with the launching of the Reformation at Wittenberg in 1517, where he famously was said to have attached his 95 points of defiance to the castle church door. And I visited myself, as many others have done, Wittenberg. And as you will know, if you visited it, there is an enormous amount of stuff on Luther, including some wonderful displays of the caricatures of the period. And then, of course, as the other key moment, if you like, foundation moment of Protestantism in the German lands, you have his declaration of his independence of faith. One might say somewhat egotistical and narcissistic declaration, but that is the nature of people who see themselves as religious leaders or prophets. Before Emperor Charles V at the Diet of Worms, otherwise spelt Worms, in 1521. And I think it's reasonable to say that for most ordinary readers, if you like, the Reformation, Luther is seen as the beginning of modern Germany, and indeed, in some respects, a key moment of the beginning of modern Europe. Well, that is, and you know, I discuss it in my book, I've discussed it in other works that I've written, that is a point of view that can be made. It's also worth thinking about, and one shouldn't judge everything in terms of the future or the past, modern or pre-modern. That can be a false dichotomy, not always a helpful contrast. But it can also be argued that Luther was another version of what one had seen previously in the later Middle Ages, most particularly with Jan Hus, the Bohemian, we would now say Czech Republic, but the Bohemian reformer, critic of papal authority, as it were, a lodestar of a kind of a quasi-political separatism in Bohemia in the early 15th century. And one might argue that the difference between Hus and Luther was partly that Luther was a more brilliant propagandist, polemicist, helped, of course, by the existence and spread of printing, but partly also of circumstances and happenstance, that Luther could have been treated rather like Hus was, dispatched to a public burning, and as it were, after a period of violence and warfare, this could have been tidied up. Rather indeed, as the 30 Years' War, at least in its initial Bohemian stage, with the rebellion breaking out in 1618, was to have been tidied up by the Habsburg victory at the Battle of the White Mountain outside Prague in 1621, and in the subsequent suppression of Protestantism and aristocratic particularism in Bohemia. So there is need for caution at reading too far from, as it were, a supposed modernity, and not least because I think it's worth pointing out that Luther himself should be seen primarily as a religious figure. He was, after all, a religious. He should be seen as a religious figure rather than being seen as some proto figure of a modern modern movement, as, for example, he was to be celebrated in East Germany in 1983, when East Germany celebrated not just the 100th anniversary of the death of Karl Marx, but also the 500th anniversary of the birth of Luther. That would have actually rather surprised Karl Marx. Luther, of course, was a vociferous anti-Semite. Semite, but for the communists, he was a progressive German and thus a figure worthy of memorialization. And the Reformation, and thereby Protestantism, was in that act and a number of other acts, including the way that Wittenberg, which was in East Germany, was looked after by the state, annexed to the communist state, which was a way to root the latter in the German past. Now, I think we can fairly say that the situation is much more complex, that however you might regard Luther in terms of modernity, by which, if you take that viewpoint, you are, I suppose, regarding papal authority and, in fact, as it were, the existing at that time Catholic rule book as definitely anti-modern, and you're arguing that there wasn't much capacity for incremental or other change within Catholicism, which I think is a dubious proposition. But what I would argue is that one needs to look at Luther's theology, just as I was lucky enough as an undergraduate to be taught at university by Jonathan Riley Smith. And he very much was a great Crusader scholar. And he argued that you had, first of all, when you were looking at the Crusades, to try and understand the theological rationale and purpose of it, and not just see it as a kind of quasi-imperial land grab. So what have we got in terms of Luther's theology? I think what we could argue, and you know, this is complex and I'm trying to just summarize, is that in response to the certainty of sin, and Luther was very much certain that there was sin. He, in some respects, if you read him, he rather reveled in sin, one might argue. In response to the certainty of sin, he believed, he asserted that there was justification through faith in the promise of Christ, and also in the certainty of grace, in other words, of divine mercy, rather than winning salvation by means of good works. Now, this was a theological proposition. It wasn't unique to Luther. It wasn't actually terribly original. And there's a lot about Luther that is very unoriginal. But it was, you know, powerfully argued by him. It was linked to criticism of the church and the specific challenges posed by financing the church via indulgences. In other words, by, as it were, getting your salvation paid for in advance. On top of that, Luther encapsulated a sense that there needed to be some change in the organization of ecclesiastical affairs, certainly in Germany and indeed more generally. And there also, there was the particular pressure in his career of a sequence of issues and conjunctures, so that the emphasis of what Luther is saying in 1517 is not quite the emphasis of what he is saying in subsequent junctures. And as well, one has to consider the stress on scripture, which very much is associated with Luther. And that was a sense that could be newly weaponized in the context of the impact of the new world of print. So all of that helps to turn Luther, who's in some ways a rather irritating, obsessed, self-obsessed maverick, it helps to turn him into a cause. And therefore, Luther can be taken up by influential groups, notably important princes, nobles, and urban groups, who have their own theological and religious interests, but also wish very much to see a rationale for a break from Rome. Now, the fact that the Reformation also rapidly took off in other countries indicates, of course, that it wasn't specifically German, but nevertheless, there was a key German dimension, certainly in its origin and early history, and it was one that Luther tried to harness, notably in his famous work To the Christian Nobility of the German Nation, came out in 1520, written and printed in German rather than Latin. And in that, he calls on the laity to champion the reforming role of the church and argues that it's one the church was unwilling to take. Now, again, that is not absolutely completely new. In fact, you could go and say that in part, he's drawing on the tradition almost of imperial anti-popes in the medieval period having a go at the papacy, with Luther as a kind of role and would-be role as the imperial anti-pope. That's going too far, possibly, but it's something worth thinking about. And Luther is challenging the church's sole right to interpret scripture and that of the Pope alone to call a general council of the church or to discuss spiritual matters. Again, that is not new, but it is certainly very much pushed to the fore and pushed to the public by Luther. And I wonder if you've got some points and observations at this stage, Graham.
Well, I have indeed. Professor Black, I mean, I'm very interested in how historians look at Luther the theologian and Luther the religious figure, but also Luther as the bringer of political change and social change as well. In your beginning of your earlier remarks, you mentioned how many historians see, not all, but many historians see Luther as a founder of modern Germany. Given that Germany was not united by Protestantism, indeed the Reformation created a great divide between a Catholic South and a Protestant North, I mean, how sensible do you think a shorthand it is to see him as one of the founding figures of modern Germany?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily sensible. I mean, I discuss in my book how Valhalla, if you've ever been on a ship, a boat along the Danube, you will have seen Valhalla. It's a rather dramatic kind of Parthenon building, well, without the Turks blowing it up, constructed in 1842 on the Danube near Regensburg on the north bank. And it was done by Ludwig I of Bavaria, that's not Mad Ludwig, and he sought to commemorate the 118 German worthies in order to help demonstrate what he saw as an exemplary national past. Now, of course, Bavaria was a Catholic country, and indeed in the German history of the Germans, published by the German scholar Michael Schmidt earlier at the beginning of the century and the end of the previous one, had been very critical of the Reformation. Well, Ludwig gets round this, because there was a lot of criticism in this debate, by arguing that he's not going to celebrate Luther as the founder of Protestantism, but rather as the translator of the Bible into German. Now, that's a way of doing it. I think it's fair to say that most Catholics found it quite difficult to accommodate themselves in the 19th century to a positive view of Luther. And on top of that, the way in which Prussian rule was experienced in the German Wars of Unification, particularly the Austro-Prussian War of 1866, in which the Prussians duffed up those Germans who weren't supporting them, which included not just Protestants in the case of Hanover, Hessen, Kassel, but also Catholics in the case of Bavaria in particular. I think it's fair to say, and then of course the Prussians went on under Bismarck to have a so-called culture war, a sort of assault on the prerogatives and position, particularly in education, of the Catholic Church. I would actually say that Protestantism was an extraordinarily divisive factor within Germany, and that it only became not so with the federal constitution of West Germany after World War II, which was a federal constitution that in effect left Bavaria and the Palatinate, the two of the land provinces with the particularly strong Catholic culture, it left them in a really autonomous position for their in a lot of their politics, and therefore it didn't matter so much if the SPD took over from the CDU or the CSU at the federal level. Prior to that, I would say the Reformation is extremely divisive, and one of the reasons that inhibits What you might otherwise, if you were being teleological, which I try not to be, assume should be the development of either a more effective German state as some sort of centralized state, which I don't think was possible, or more feasibly, the development of a more effective federal state of the First Reich in the of the decentralized German constitution, but under Habsburg imperial leadership. So in a way, Protestant aristocratic and princely opposition to the Catholics, whether you're starting with with the Elector of Saxony protecting Luther at the beginning of the 1520s, or whether you're thinking of Frederick the Great of Prussia invading Silesia in 1740, at every stage can be seen as limiting the potential of a more effective federal Catholic imperial system.
One of the features of very dynamic figures like Luther is that everyone else can read their own particular hobby horses into what they are trying to achieve. You mentioned the East German communists in the 1980s trying to portray Luther as a more socially democratic and anti-hierarchical leader. Is that, do you think, what Luther set out to achieve, or should we see the strife that followed the Peasants' War, which had an economic dimension as well as a religious one, but the Peasants' War, the Anabaptists in Munster, which is very had a very bloody denouement. Should we see these as events which could have been avoided with different handling, or are they actually really part of a turning of the world upside down that the Lutheran Reformation necessitated?
Well, that's interesting. Very interesting. I mean, as you know, there were a number of conflicts which one can think about. There was the Knights' War of 1522-3, which is the free imperial knights under pressure from economic and political change, in a sense of falling into conflict with some of the princes. There was a religious dimension in part, but not completely. The Peasants' War, which follows 1524-5, again, social tension and economic discontent plays a very significant role, notably the impact of rising population and rents, but also, as you correctly say, the questioning of authority that is part of the volatile atmosphere of the Reformation helps to engender the situation, although it's also fair to note that some peasant communities remain strongholds of Catholicism. So again, I think one has to be careful there. Then you mention the Anabaptists at Munster, who take over the Prince Bishopric of Munster, its episcopal town, in 1534, establish a reign of terror over the ungodly. What a surprise, exactly like a sort of modern woke gone mad, only for the city to be successfully besieged in 1535. Well, the Anabaptists of Munster were in the end as unwelcome to Protestants as they were to Catholics. I mean, they showed that you can have very radical alternatives in that period, including polygamy, but that very few pursued them. Then on top of that, as I've already alluded to, you've got actually conflict at a higher, by higher, I just mean higher social level. So the Schmalkaldic League, the League of the Protestant Princes, is created in 1531, and that leads to war with the Habsburgs in 1546-47. Now, of all of those, there is obviously a religious dimension, just as there's a religious dimension with anti-Semitic violence, the expulsion of the Jews from Regensburg in 1519, for example. But I think one has to not see these as either ors, nor necessarily say, oh, well, it's 60% of one and 40% of the other, and historian B or blogs say, well, no, actually, I think it's 50% of each. I think you've got much more of an interaction of factors in which the volatility of the period has an impact, but individuals and communities and families and kindred groups respond differently in particular contingencies.
The creation of the Elizabethan settlement in England is seen as an attempt at compromise. There are, you know, Catholic elements of worship, but within a broadly Protestant theology. What was were the moments, you know, lost moments where compromise could have reunified the German states across a system which the majority of people from high to low would have accepted?
Well, there were certainly attempts at religious reconciliation. I mean, you've got one, and they've been written about by in the specialist literature. You've got one at the Diet of Augsburg in 1530. You've got one at the Diet of Regensburg in 1541. You've got the suggestions that are made that there should be a general council of the church as a way of, as it were, trying to move towards a solution to the problem. You've also got, at the local level, some rulers seeking compromise. So, for example, Hermann von Wieder, the Archbishop-Elector of Cologne, seeks what you might see as a broad church compromise at the local level. And Henry VIII's short-term brother-in-law, Wilhelm Duke of Jülich-Cleves-Berg, I mean, the brother of Anne of Cleves, seeks to do the same. So I think it would be mistaken to say there were no compromises. And you could argue, if you like, that the Peace of Augsburg itself, which brings war to an end in 1555, is actually a compromise. I mean, it's a compromise in the sense they no longer believe that they can provide a theological resolution or an organizational, thus ecclesiastical resolution, which is going to settle these matters, but they believe that they might be able to have a resolution which allows different emphases in particular areas, the famous principle of whose realm, his religion. In other words, that Lutheran rulers could make Lutheranism the religion of their territories. So I wouldn't say that compromise wasn't sought. I would say it didn't work. And there's a whole host of reasons. First of all, there were incompatible positions over in ecclesiastical matters, particularly over papal authority. And, you know, there is the classic view, I think it's pushed too far, but there is the classic view that Italian figures round the Pope helped to subvert the chances of a compromise and therefore to blame for all of this. There is the also of, you know, you have to say there was on the Protestant side a kind of consolidation of a new position. So Landgrave Philip of Hesse, who becomes the leading princely supporter of Lutheranism, is quite happy to allow himself to be applauded by the late 1520s, even more 1530s, as the true heir of Charlemagne, the, you know, the person who really, as it were, encapsulates destiny rather than the Emperor Charles V, the Habsburg Emperor. So there are those factors. Then there are, of course, the factors of external intervention, of which I would say the most important are in the very short term, Charles V's distraction at the beginning of his period of power by the fact that as Carlos I of Spain, he faces the Comuneros rebellion in Castile and the Germania rebellion in Valencia. And what that does is mean he cannot devote the due attention that is required in his German lands, and that that is then accentuated through the 1520s by war with Francis I of France, a war that continues till 1529, restarts again in the mid-1530s, restarts again in the 1540s. And then you've also got the advance of Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Sultan, who captures Belgrade in 1521, defeats and kills Louis II of Hungary, Bohemia-Hungary, in 1526, and by 1529 is besieging Vienna. And as you can imagine, that also poses priorities. So I think you could say that whether or not a German solution was possible, and the nature of Christian church organization and theology suggests that it wasn't, and that, you know, you would always going to have a either a brutal suppression of Protestantism by the Catholics or a federal agreement of some type, whether or not that was going to be the outcome, the external commitments of the Habsburgs make it very difficult to bring the issue to fruition earlier on.
Well, we discussed in the previous podcast about the relationship between the German states and the Holy Roman Empire. You were saying a moment ago about the Emperor Charles V. He is distracted by events in his realm in Spain. Is it slightly getting into counterfactual territory? Do you think if the Holy Roman Emperor had been a more recognisably, you know, a German ruler, able to devote himself entirely to the problems in Germany in the 16th century, first half of the 16th century, could that have been fundamentally different? Are we talking about a failure of statecraft, or the problems are too big for a Holy Roman Emperor to surmount?
Well, that's, again, a very interesting question. I mean, the empire itself is not restricted to Germany. I mean, the empire itself includes dominions that we would not now see as Germany. I mean, for example, Bohemia, which is now in the Czech Republic, large amount of northern Italy, particularly the Milanese, Lombardy, what we would call Belgium and Luxembourg. So I don't... and you know, they were in Switzerland, and the Netherlands were parts of although they were not part of the imperial circle system. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think counterfactuals are very valuable. You know, I have written two books, in fact, on counterfactuals, of which I would certainly, those listeners interested, I would certainly urge them to look at my book, Other Pasts. But I think in this case, the proposition of a German, as it were, Holy Roman Emperor, really looks at the propaganda of the Second Reich, the empire from 1871 to 1918, the Prussian Reich, if you like, directed against Austria, with the notion that what was known as Kleindeutsch, a smaller Germany, as it were, was truer to a kind of German policy than a Grossdeutsche one, in which the emperor in some respects was also pursuing territorial and other interests stemming from his position in Austria and so on. Now, I don't think it was feasible in the early 16th century to have imagined an emperor, if we wish to call them the Holy Roman Emperor, it's a term that has some problems, but I don't think it's feasible to imagine an emperor who was, if you like, the secular arm of the Pope as being able readily to part from an interest in northern Italy territorially or an interest in helping the papacy.
And, well, I wonder if we can turn to that period in the 50 years or so before the 30 Years' War breaks out. So I'm really thinking about the period between the various attempts of settlement or at any rate to prevent things getting worse. So you mentioned, you know, the idea of, you know, whoever, you know, the state has the religion of the ruler. I mean, how well did these attempts at settlement work? Did they hold the peace quite well in the second half of the 16th century, or should we really see them as no more than sticking plasters which were breached continually?
Well, that's an interesting... but first of all, just as a general observation, I think historians are a little inclined to sometimes imagine, as do a lot of commentators or political polemicists, that you can have a world without, as you put it, sticking plasters. I think many of us would be jolly happy to have sticking plasters more available at the present day around the world. So I'm not sure, you know, a lot of the world is a matter of getting from one crisis to another. Maybe that's because I'm a pessimist and a depressive that I say that, but I do genuinely believe it to be the case. And I am by background, you know, I've written a lot of books, but I'm by background an archival historian. I always try and use archival material for this book. I used archival material from the late 17th and 18th century. And it is always, in my mind, shot through with uncertainty. So I wouldn't like to say that there was an inevitability about failure, because there was a certainty of crisis, but then most situations are full of crisis. I mean, to go back, I mean, I'm not trying to criticize you, but you argued that Elizabeth I solved the problem by a compromise. Well, I might point out to you that there was the Northern Rising in the northeast and northwest, particularly the northeast of England at the end of the 1560s. There were a host of Catholic conspiracies against Elizabeth. There was on the Protestant side, if you want to call that, think in those terms, radical Protestants, we call them Puritans, who made life a misery for the government, particularly in Parliament, and also made life a misery for a lot of the bishops. So, you know, you could look at it very different ways. So go to Germany, for example, you know, there's conflict in the Archbishopric Electorate of Cologne, which is a very important one. It's one of the electorates, one of the, you know, of which there are only seven, from 1583 to 1588. What happens is the Archbishop Elector converts to Protestantism, in part because he wishes to marry a Protestant canoness, which he does in 1583. He then tries to hold on to it, whereupon the Spaniards intervene on behalf of a Bavarian candidate who is victorious, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that means he also grabs other parts of that Episcopal powerhouse. So he also becomes, you know, the Bishop of Munster in 1584. And yet that does not lead to a major war, nor does the war between 1609 and 1614 over the inheritance of the United Rhenish Duchies of Jülich, Kleve and Berg, which is, you know, very significant territories in the Lower Rhineland, which has contests between two heirs, a Wittelsbach and a Hohenzollern. It has the interventions on opposite sides of Dutch and Spanish forces. Henry IV of France is murdered in 1610 on this eve of French intervention. There is a Protestant union of princes, and yet that doesn't lead to a general war. And in fact, the Treaty of Xanthan in 1614 sees the whole issue settled, and that settlement continues, in fact, actually lasts. So I think what one has got is a need for caution. It's certainly true, as I argue in my book, that religious division helps to ensure that whereas in the late 15th century, politics and warfare in northern Germany were only loosely connected to events in southern Germany, I would say that is less the case from the 1530s onwards, and that there is more of a concern about the position of co-religionists elsewhere in the empire. So that is potentially very troubling, as well as the fact that the imperial dignity is elective, and that means that one has to be particularly concerned about who controls the three clerical electorates, Cologne, Mainz and Trier. But there is also the anxiety when you've got lines of rulers, lay rulers, coming to an end because the people are childless, and that there is then contests within the succession. So that happens in Hessen. That happens, for example, as I've already indicated, in Jülich Kleve, Burke. It is going to happen in the Habsburg dominions in the beginning of the 17th century. And ultimately, that is one of the things that kicks off the crisis that we're going to talk about next time, known as the 30 Years' War. But I would be loath to say that there was an inevitability about failure.
Right. Well, I want to end by asking a question more about the cultural and societal world of Germany in the 16th century. Should we look for content? We're naturally looking to see what effect the Reformation had on thinking and creativity and destruction. But should we also be looking for the continuities? Is there a thread of German intellectual thought and development which, if not carrying on without regard to the strife of religious reform, it nevertheless isn't fundamentally twisted by it?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. I mean, Germany at the beginning of the 16th century, I would locate high culture there in terms of what one thinks about as the Northern Renaissance. And you may recall we discussed that last time. And the Northern Renaissance has an element that is late Gothic, much more so than you would associate with anything south of the Alps. And I would say that in the 16th century, you get, as indeed the same thing in England, you get a continuation of that late Gothic theme, but also more influences coming in from the Italian Renaissance. Now, interestingly enough, you could argue, you've always, in my view, got to be very careful how you position people, just as we would wish to be careful how people position us. You could argue that Martin Luther, in some respects, is a late Gothic figure. You could argue that in some respects, he is, if you wish to use the term, therefore, a kind of anachronism, but you could turn that on its head and say that, as a man who is fluent, who turns to the printing press, he is somebody who is astute at noting new cultural means, even if his content is not particularly novel or, to use a later term, enlightened.
Well, we'll have to leave that there. It's very interesting. Professor Jeremy Black, whose A Brief History of Germany is published now, taking us through the Germany of the 16th century. Very interesting indeed. And next week, we will pick the story up with the 30 Years' War.
Yes. And could I also just mention to listeners who some people tell me that they enjoy this series of books as well as the series of podcasts. One of the books that is linked to some of the podcasts we have already done, we did a series of podcasts on a history of the Atlantic. I always worry that the critic lets some of my podcasts slip away to destruction, but bully them hard. And there is a series of podcasts on the history of the Atlantic, and the book, A Brief History of the Atlantic, is due in the bookshops on the 2nd of June. And I hope people will find that of interest as well.
Well, that's great news. And I can confirm that none of the podcasts are lost. They are all available via the Critic website.
Okay, that's excellent. Thank you very much, Graham.
Thank you very much, Professor Black.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.